Good morning, everyone. We talked about this yesterday. We were anticipating these numbers.
I think we're going to end up talking about it a lot more in the future also.
Well, here's a straightforward news story on the takeaway. The new census data for 2009 was released yesterday. It shows that U.S. poverty rates have hit a 15-year high and are approaching 1960s levels, 15% people below the poverty line in the United States, when President Lyndon Johnson spoke these words.
And this administration today, here and now, declares unconditional war on poverty in America.
Again, that was back in 1964. Well, the war on poverty continued. Either we've surrendered or something significantly different is happening in the economy for that rise in poverty to be reported yesterday by the census numbers. We want to have a kind of a different discussion on what the war on poverty and the threshold of the poverty line actually means in the United States. Ron Haskins joins us. He's a senior fellow of economic studies and co-director of the Center on Children and Families at the Brookings Institution. Good morning again, Ron.
Good morning.
And we bring in our friend and expert on development issues around the world, Jacqueline Novogratz, who's the founder and CEO of the Acumen Fund. Her book, The Blue Sweater, Bridging the Gap Between Rich and Poor in an Interconnected World, tells a story of how it's not so much the poverty line that matters, it's the relationship between the people at the bottom of the economic ladder and the top of the economic ladder. Jacqueline, is that about right?
That's right. Nice to hear you, John.
It's great to talk to you this morning. First, Ron, let's get more into this idea of the poverty line as a political marker. The political system sets where the poverty line is. It may or may not be based in economic reality. What do these numbers that came out yesterday tell us as a snapshot of the U.S. economy right now?
They tell us that a lot more people are unemployed, and they tell us that there's a lot more misery. And the most important part, you didn't mention this, but poverty is also up quite substantially among children, which is my greatest concern. So there's more misery generated primarily because there's less employment.
How frustrating is it to you that, as you say, this is a moving target? The political forces can sort of place this marker wherever they want. They can make the picture look better or worse, depending upon what it is they want to accomplish.
Right. Well, the political process has never changed the poverty level, except it's adjusted each year by inflation. But there is a lot of discussion. There's been a tremendous amount of work, especially since a report from the National Academy of Science in 1995. I think there's widespread agreement that our poverty level, the way we measure poverty in the United States, makes absolutely no sense. Some people even say it's the worst federal statistic because it just does not reflect reality. Not just because it's how do you live a family of four on $22,000 or $23,000 a year, but because the way the actual level is calculated, way people's income is calculated is flawed, because lots of income is not counted.
Right.
So there are serious flaws in the measure. The administration would very much like to change it, and they will present a new measure. It'll be an experimental measure, but it will be presented next year at this time.
And that could change the number again, but again, it will be a statistical change. Ron Haskins from the Brookings Institution. Jacqueline Novogratz, the relationship between people at the bottom of the income ladder and the top, how has that manifested itself as the real marker of the significance of poverty in the places you visited around the world?
Acumen works in Pakistan, India, and East Africa, where the gap between rich and poor is enormous and in some of the countries widening. And the manifestation is, I think, really about dignity and this sense of, if I'm so far behind and people are moving further ahead, it doesn't really matter if my absolute level of wealth is getting a little bit better. If I feel even further behind than others, there's a sense of being left out of the system. There's a sense of not having access to choice. And that is where I think you start to get major rifts in populations. You see, unfortunately, what we're starting to see in the United States, much more investment by the rich on security and building their own private systems. And that's where you have society breakdown.
Interesting. I want to talk about the United States in a moment. Can you give an example of where the absolute number of poverty is actually terrifying to an American, but because there is this sense that we're all in it together, a more communal sense in the nation, it ameliorates the idea of poverty and people feel less poor?
I do a lot of work in the Kibera slums outside of Nairobi, and it's really interesting in that a whole group of slum dwellers read my book, 100 of them, And when, and the whole book is about poverty in Rwanda and genocide, and the way they read it was not about themselves. They saw my stories of failure in it. They wanted to be part of solving the gap between rich and poor themselves. They talked about people who are less well off than they are. They want to be seen. They want to be visible. And they want to be working on solutions to bring themselves better sanitation, better health care, and are doing so. I think the issue for low-income communities like that is often wanting to be connected to the larger economy, finding those opportunities, but a real willingness to be seen and being part of it.
Ron, the definition of poor kind of cuts both ways. I mean, I know the $22,000 for a family of four is an incredibly small amount of money. And often that political line is drawn because that's where people start getting social services. People will move that line down in order to keep costs down. And therefore, I imagine there's a whole lot of people who feel like they're not cutting it, like they're below the poverty line, but they don't qualify.
Well, actually, the poverty line does figure in some eligibility for some programs, but we have a vast array of programs, and some are based on a poverty line and some not. The Earned Income Tax Credit, which is a $50 billion program, all the money goes to families who are low income, but many of the families are well above the poverty level. It goes all the way up to almost $40,000. And there are other programs like that as well. So we have a lot of people who are well above poverty who still get benefits.
Well, Eugenia, listen to this, Ron and Jacqueline. When I started getting phone calls from creditors for the first time in my life, one thing that would make me feel rich was eating a tablespoon or two of sour cream. Now I feel poor because I'm still homeless after my foreclosure. I also have two infected teeth I can't do anything about. I want to save my teeth, and I can't. That's her definition of poverty. Jacqueline Novogratz, do you think there's development work to do here in the United States if you were to parachute in?
I think there's extraordinary development work to be done and huge opportunity, John. What we're seeing in social innovation here could be connected to bringing greater dignity
right,
in.
Right, right.
And I think there are social entrepreneurs like what we're seeing in education with Michelle Rhee in D.C. and new schools that are trying to really think about our kids with more investment strategies, even when you look at food.
Well, it's way beyond the numbers, thinking about poverty not as a line but as a set of relationships. Jacqueline Novogratz, founder and CEO of the Acumen Fund, and Ron Haskins, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Thanks to you both.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.